Hi, hello, welcome. This is Alex, one half of Cryptid Queens, and today I'm going to cover a really, really crazy case that is unsolved. I'm going to start off with my sources here. I got my information from an article from the Daily Beast by Megan Palin, and then I got a bunch of information from Wikipedia, and then a website called UFOinsight.com, and then a website called Medium.com. Today I'm covering the death of the Somerton Man. So on December 1st, 1948 at 6:30 a.m., the police were contacted after the body of a man was discovered on Somerton Park Beach near Glenelg, about 7 miles southwest of Adelaide in South Australia. The man was found lying in the sand on his back. His head was resting against the seawall with his legs extended and his feet crossed. It was as if the man died there sleeping. He was in a sleeping position. An unlit cigarette was on the right collar of his coat. In his pockets were an unused second-class rail ticket from Adelaide to Henley Beach, a potentially unused bus ticket from the city, a narrow aluminum comb that had been manufactured in the United States, a half-empty packet of Juicy Fruit chewing gum, an Army Club cigarette packet, which contained 7 cigarettes of a different brand, and a quarter full box of Bryant and May matches. To be honest, it sounds a lot like all of the typical things that would be in the pockets of a man from the 40s. Nothing too special. So after police discovered the body, they started interviewing people that were around the neighborhood the night and that morning. Witnesses who came forward said that on the evening before, they had seen an individual resembling the dead man lying on his back in the same spot, same position, where the corpse was later found. A couple who actually saw him around 7 p.m. noted that they saw him extend his right arm upward to the fullest extent and then drop it limply. Another couple between 7:30 and 8 p.m. actually saw the man as well, and they commented between themselves that it was odd that he was not reacting to the mosquitoes, and they had thought it more likely that he was drunk or asleep, and thus did not investigate any further. A police report was made by Detective Don O'Doherty. According to the pathologist John Burton Cleland, the man was a, quote, Britisher appearance and thought to be aged at about 40 to 45 years old and appeared to be in top physical condition. 5'11", with gray eyes, fair to ginger-colored hair, slightly gray around the temples, with broad shoulders and a narrow waist, hands and nails that showed no signs of manual labor, big and little toes that met in a wedge shape like those of a dancer or someone who wore boots with pointed toes, and pronounced high calf muscles, consistent with people who regularly wore boots or shoes with high heels or performed ballet. So he could have been a dancer. He was in top physical condition, but he was dressed in a white shirt, a red and white blue tie, brown trousers, socks and shoes, a brown knitted pullover, and a fashionable gray and brown double-breasted jacket of reportedly American tailoring. All of the labels on his clothes had been removed, and he had no hat on, which was usual in 1948, and then he didn't even have a wallet on him. So he was clean-shaven and carried no ID. Finally, his dental records were not able to match to any known person. An autopsy was conducted, and the pathologist estimated the time of death at around 2 a.m. on December 1st. The autopsy showed that the man's last meal was a pasty, eaten 3 to 4 hours before his death, but tests failed to reveal any foreign substances in the body. The pathologist, Dr. Dwyer, concluded that the death wasn't natural. Other than that, the coroner wasn't able to reach a conclusion as to the man's identity. The body was then embalmed on December 10th after the police were unable to get a positive identification. So here's where things start to get even weirder. On January 14th, the next year, staff at the Adelaide Railway Station discovered a brown suitcase with its label removed. And the suitcase had been checked into the station after 11 a.m. the day before this man was discovered on the beach. They do believe that the suitcase was owned by this dead man that they found. So in this case was a red checked dressing gown, red felt pair of slippers, 4 pairs of underpants, pajamas, shaving items, a light brown pair of trousers with sand in the cuffs, an electrician screwdriver, a table knife cut down into a short, sharp instrument, a pair of scissors with sharpened points, a small square of zinc thought to have been used to protect sheath for the knife and scissors, and a stenciling brush, which is used on merchant ships to stencil cargo, like the writing that you see on the side of like big cargo boxes, which is odd. All identification marks of the clothes had been removed, but police found the name T. Keane, K-E-A-N-E, on a tie, Keane on a laundry bag, and Keane on an undershirt. Police believe that whoever removed the clothes tags either overlooked these three items or purposely left the Keane tags on the clothes. A search concluded that no T. Keane was missing in any English-speaking country. All that could be garnered from the suitcase was that the tailoring on a coat found in the case indicated it had been manufactured in the United States. So police checked incoming train records and believed the man had arrived at the Adelaide Railway Station by overnight train from either Melbourne, Sydney, or Port Augusta. They speculated he had went to the train station to purchase a ticket for the 10:50 a.m. train to Henley Beach, which for whatever reason he missed or didn't catch. He immediately checked his suitcase at the station before leaving the station and catching a city bus to Glenelg, which is where he was found. A few weeks later, the investigating pathologists re-examined the body and made a number of discoveries. He noted that the man's shoes were remarkably clean and appeared to have been recently polished, rather than in the condition expected of a man who had apparently been wandering around Glenelg all day. He added that this evidence fit with the theory that the body may have been placed there on the beach after his death, accounting for the lack of evidence of vomiting and convulsions, which are two main physiological reactions to poison. Early in the inquiry, Cleland stated, "I would be prepared to find that he died from poison, that the poison was probably a glucoside, and that it was not accidentally administered. But I could not say whether it was administered by the deceased himself or by some other person." So this specific type of chemical can be long undetected in a person after death, which is why the autopsy didn't find anything. Around this same time, a tiny piece of rolled up paper with the words "Tamam Shud" printed on it was found in a fob pocket sewn within the dead man's pants. So public library officials were called in to translate the text. They identified it as a phrase meaning ended or finished, found on the last page of Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. The paper's reverse side was blank. People conducted an Australia-wide search to find a copy of the book that had a similarly blank reverse, and a photograph of the scrap paper was released to the press. Following a public appeal by police, the copy of Rubaiyat from which the page had been torn was located. A man actually showed police a 1941 edition of Edward Fitzgerald's translation of Rubaiyat, published by Whitcomb and Toombs in Christchurch, New Zealand. The man who had found the copy was flabbergasted after he saw an article in the previous day's paper, and what's crazy is that he'd been at the Somerton Beach the afternoon that the man was found, and he actually left his vehicle unlocked. So it sounds like someone just placed it in his car. So former South Australia police detective Gary Feltis reported that the book was found, quote, "just after that man was found on the beach at Somerton. The timing is significant as the man is presumed, based on the suitcase, to have arrived in Adelaide the day before he was found on the beach." So the Rubaiyat is a really interesting book. The theme is that one should live life to the fullest and have no regrets when it ends. And the poem's subject led police to theorize that the man had committed suicide by poison, although no other evidence corroborated this theory. The copy of the book in the car that was found was missing the words "Tamam Shud" on the last page, which had a blank reverse. And microscopic tests indicated that the piece of rolled up paper was indeed from the book that was discovered. Also, in the back of the book were faint indentations representing five lines of text in capital letters. None of it really makes sense, and it's all gibberish, so I'm just going to post a picture of it on our Instagram, because it's literally just a bunch of random letters put together. So initially, the letters were thought to be words in a foreign language, but investigators soon realized that it was actually a code of some kind. Code experts were called in at the time to decipher the lines, but were unsuccessful. In 1978, cryptographers analyzed the text, only to say that it would be impossible to provide a satisfactory answer. They determined that it was basically just gibberish. A telephone number was also found in the back of this book, belonging to a nurse named Jessica Ellen Thompson. So, born Jessie Harkness in 1927 in the Sydney suburb of Merrickville, New South Wales, she lived on Mosley Street, 1,300 feet north of the location where the body was found. When she was interviewed by police, Thomas said that she did not know the dead man or why he would have her phone number. However, she also reported at some time in late 1948, an unidentified man had come to her house when she wasn't there and ended up asking a neighbor about her. Investigators recall that she was quite evasive and didn't seem like she wanted to talk about the matter at all. Because of this, some investigators obviously believed that Thompson actually knew the Somerton man's identity. Thompson's daughter Kate, in an interview in 2014 with 60 Minutes, also said that she believed that her mother knew the dead man. The investigators had also created a plaster cast of the bust of the dead man, and they actually showed that plaster cast to Jessica, but she still couldn't identify him. According to investigators, though, her reaction upon seeing the cast was, quote, completely taken back, to the point of giving the appearance that she was about to faint. In an interview many years later, Paul Lawson, the technician who made the cast and was present when Thompson viewed it, noted that after looking at the bust, she immediately looked away and would not look at it again. Thompson also said that while she was working at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney during World War II, she had owned a copy of Rubaiyat. And in 1945, at the Clifton Gardens Hotel in Sydney, she had given it to an Australian Army lieutenant named Alf Boxall. So, I know what you guys are thinking, maybe this man is Alf. Thomas told police that after the war had ended, she had moved to Melbourne and married. She said that she had received a letter from Boxall and had replied telling him that she was now married and she couldn't get with him. So, there's no evidence at all that Boxall had any contact with Jessica Thompson after 1945. As a result of their conversations with Thomas, police suspected that Boxall was the dead man. But in July 1949, Boxall was found in Sydney, and the final page of his copy of the Rubaiyat was intact, with the words Tamam Shud still in place. So Boxall was now working in the maintenance section of the Randwick Bus Depot and was unaware of any link between the dead man and himself. There's some crazy theories here. After the Somerton man was found, newspapers began to publish investigative articles about the circumstances of his death. As one journalist wrote in 1949, alluding to the line in Rubaiyat, quote, "The Somerton man seemed to have made certain that the glass would be empty." An editorial stated that if this man died by poison so rare and obscure, then surely the culprit's advanced knowledge of toxic substances pointed to something more serious than a mere domestic poisoning. There has been persistent speculation that the dead man was actually a spy. So think about it. It's 1945, and at least two sites relatively close to Adelaide were of interest to spies. The Radium Hill uranium mine and the Woomera Test Range, which was an Anglo-Australian military research facility. The man's death also coincided with a reorganization of Australia's security agencies, which would culminate in the following year with the founding of the Australian Security Intelligence Organization. I'm guessing it's basically like the CIA of Australia. This would actually be followed by a crackdown on Soviet espionage in Australia. So maybe he was a Soviet spy. Who fucking knows? But former South Australian Chief Superintendent Len Brown, who worked on the case in the 1940s, did believe that he indeed was from a country in the Warsaw Pact, which led to the police's inability to confirm the man's identity. Basically, the Warsaw Pact was a collective defense treaty signed in Warsaw, Poland between Soviet Union and a bunch of the Eastern Bloc countries. And it makes sense because literally no one in, what, the 80 years since his death has ever claimed that they knew this person or that they knew his identity. So it basically made it really hard to get any type of information from any of those countries during that time. Another theory concerns Boxall, who was reportedly involved in intelligence work during and immediately after World War II. In a 1978 television interview, when Boxall was asked about the case, he simply said, quote, "It's quite a melodramatic thesis, isn't it?" Boxall's army service record suggested that he served initially in the 4th Water Transport Company before being sent to the North Australian Observer Unit, which was actually a special ops unit, and during his time there, Boxall rose rapidly in rank, being promoted from Lance Corporal to Lieutenant within 3 months of being there. Years after the Somerton man was buried in a local cemetery, flowers began appearing at the grave. Police questioned a woman seen leaving the cemetery, but she claimed she knew nothing of the man. As far as the gibberish code on the back of the book, there have been numerous unsuccessful attempts in the 80 plus years since this discovery to crack the letters. A 2014 analysis by computational linguist John Railing concludes that the letters were likely written as a form of shorthand, not as code, and that the original text can likely never be determined. Shorthand writing is basically an abbreviated way to write English, like G-O-V-T instead of government, stuff like that. So later on in the investigation, police actually found pieces of hair from the plaster bust that was created, and later on they used this to try to identify the man. But other key evidence actually no longer exists, such as the brown suitcase, which was destroyed in 1986. In addition, witness statements have disappeared from the police file over the years. So, two questions. Why? And why? That makes no sense whatsoever. So, an investigation had shown that the Somerton man's autopsy reports of 48 and 49 are now missing, as well as the collection of one of the original investigators' notes. But this is what we do know. Dr. Hennenberg, professor of anatomy at the University of Adelaide, examined images of the Somerton man's ears, basically found that the upper ear hollow and the lower ear hollow were larger than a lot of other people, and this feature was actually possessed by only 1 to 2% of the Caucasian population. And in May 2009, an investigator consulted with dental experts who concluded that the Somerton man also had a special genetic disorder of both lateral incisors. So, two very distinct physical attributes to this man that only a really small percentage of people had. In June 2010, an investigator obtained a photograph of Jessica Thompson's eldest son, Robin, which clearly showed that he, just like the unknown Somerton man, had not only a larger ear hollow, but also this rare condition of his incisors. So the chance that this was a coincidence had been estimated as between 1 in 10 million and 1 in 20 million. Does this mean that the Somerton man was this dude's dad? Was Jessica having an affair with the Somerton man? So in July 2013, investigator Abbott released an artistic impression he commissioned of the Somerton man, believing this might finally lead to an identification. He said, quote, "All this time we've been publishing the autopsy photo, and it's hard to tell what someone looks like from that." And really crazy side note, he actually ended up marrying Robin Thompson's daughter, who could potentially be related to the Somerton man. So in December 2017, Abbott was actually the investigator that found the hairs from the plaster bust. And while much of the DNA was degraded, in February 2018, the University of Adelaide obtained an analysis of DNA from the hair sample. What they could find out from this is that the Somerton man belonged to a haplogroup possessed by 1% of Europeans. However, mitochondrial DNA is only inherited through the maternal line and therefore cannot be used to investigate a hereditary link between Rachel Egan, which was Abbott's wife, and the Somerton man. it gets a little crazier here. In November 2013, Kate Thompson, the daughter of Jessica, actually said that her mother had told her she had lied to police about the Somerton man, that Jessica did know the identity of this man, also, quote, known to a level higher than the police force. She suggested that her mother and the Somerton man may both have been spies, noting that Jessica Thompson taught English to migrants, was interested in communism, and could speak Russian, although she would not disclose to her daughter when she had learned it and why. Like, hello. It just screams Russian espionage to me. In October 2019, Attorney General Vicky Chapman granted approval for the Somerton man's body to be exhumed for DNA analysis. So an exhumation was carried out in May of 2021, and the authorities have said that they do intend to take DNA from the remains if possible. Speaking at the gravesite ahead of the exhumation from last year, Detective Sept Bray said that it was, quote, important for everybody to remember the Somerton man is not just a curiosity or a mystery to be solved. It's somebody's father, son, perhaps grandfather, uncle or brother. And that's why we're doing this and trying to identify him. There are people we know that live in Adelaide. They believe they may be related, and they deserve to have a definitive answer. As of April 2022, they still haven't found an answer and are still doing DNA testing. So what makes this case even stranger is that in June 1945, 3 years before the death of the Somerton man, a 34-year-old Singaporean man named James Solheim Marshall was found dead in a park in Sydney, Australia, with an open copy of Rubaiyat on his chest. Marshall's death is believed to be a suicide by poisoning and occurred 2 months before Boxall was given the inscribed copy of Rubaiyat from Jessica. So, what the fuck could this be? I think, personally, that he was a spy and potentially didn't have any type of identification or papers on him because, obviously, he was meant to remain anonymous. Maybe he was forced to poison himself because he knew information that he wasn't supposed to know, or he knew he was a dead man anyway for some reason. As far as everything with Jessica, maybe she was also a spy, maybe during the war and continued doing it afterward, and maybe the Somerton man was her partner, and maybe they had some type of secret code or had some type of significant connection to Tamam Shud. Maybe it's not connected to the government at all. Maybe it's some like really crazy big secret society that we don't know anything about. There's so much weird and specific information that makes this case so curious. I love unsolved mysteries, and this is one where there are so many different theories that make sense. It's hard to separate them all. You could look at this case with a very large, globalized lens, but also one that doesn't go further than just a case of a John Doe committing suicide on a beach. What do you guys think? Government conspiracy? Secret society? Does it go all the way to the top? Is it aliens? Question mark? Or is this just a case of a man who took his own life on the beach? Please let me know and comment on the Instagram post that I make for this episode. Please email us at cryptidqueenspodcast@gmail.com. Our Instagram is cryptidqueenspodcast. Please rate and subscribe to our podcast on any platform that you have. It really does help us a lot. It gives us a better idea of what we can improve on and what we continue doing. I hope you guys have a spooky week that's not too spooky, but just spooky enough. And keep your eyes peeled for some Russian espionage.